Welcome to the Admin Podcast, the podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin working on a help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer tech who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And this is episode 101,011. No, it's not. I've been trying to chat up a computer today. I'll have to go back to English. 43, that's what it is. Now 43 is also the atomic number for technetium, and the Who Is protocol that uses port 43 as well.
Yeah, I did not know
that. otherwise I've got done nothing else about 43, but I think we've been busier than I have on that this week. So what's everyone else been up to?
Yeah, been busy as always. I think we've been quite slow on podcasts lately with getting these out, but hopefully we can start kind of getting these podcasts back on regular track, maybe getting two out of them. I think we only had about one a month this year so far, I think, haven't we? I think that's
something like that. We've
been. sorry for the bad audio last month as well, because we had a bit of an issue with one of the recordings, didn't we?
Yeah. So I lost my audio. I do apologise. Luckily, there was a backup. As with sysadmins, you know, there's a backup.
Yeah. So one thing you might have come across, which I'm described to you about, is about a security patch that came out on Windows under the actual MS is MS-160/16-072, and it came as a number of different knowledge bases. I'll put a link in the show notes. It's also to do about group policies and how they are applied. I mean, you probably heard me talk about group policies before. If you've got a joined domain computer, you can basically put these group policy objects against either a user or a computer object. So what this means you can do is you can push settings out to computers or users. So like you can map drives with it, you can lock down the control panel, set screen savers. There's loads and loads of things you can do with them. And normally what you do is you apply these to OUs, with organisation. You probably heard me talk about them before, in Active Directory, you have a thing where you can have OUs, and you can have all your users in one OU, and then all your computers in other OUs. And normally what you do is you apply these group policies to the OU. So if you've got a bunch of computers and you want to apply to all these computers in these OU, you assign the group policy to the OU, or if you've got a group of users, like say you had like, I don't know, all the Norwich staff, all the London staff, all the account staff, or all the programming casts or whatever, and you put them into these different folders, and then you could then assign a mapper S drive for sage for the accounts people, and you had a group an OU for accounts, all those people in accounts, you could just basically assign this group policy to the accounts folder and everyone would get that S drive. The problem is that this patch what came out which basically didn't break group policy, but I've mentioned in the previous podcast is that if you applied this and you've changed the security filtering. So what this means is let's say you've got a load of people. Let's say you've had your OU set up by site. Let's say you've got an OU and you've got like head office, and you've got one for branches or something like that. And then in your head office, you've got everyone in your head office, but you only want the accounts people to have this group policy applied. But obviously, because everyone's in that head office OU, if you basically put it to the top, you can apply that, but it will apply to everyone in that. Because what happens on the group policy, by default, there's a security policy. What says group policy is applied to users called authenticated users. But if you wanted to just apply it to the only to the to like the accounts team, so you'd have like a group group called accounts. You can go into the security tab of the group policy, and you can basically say apply it only to the group policy to the accounts team. A lot of people, luckily not me, because I knew that I've been taught from when I on my Windows Server course that you should never remove authenticated users. So normal people go in there, they remove everyone from that list and then just add in the group they want to. And in the group, what you can do is you can basically say who can read the group policy and who can basically who that group policy applies to, okay? And obviously when a group policy is made by default, if all authenticated users will basically have applied rights and read rights, okay? This means that they can read the group policy and they can apply it. So the authenticated user group is basically anyone who's authenticated against a domain. So if it's a domain computer, it means it's authenticated against a domain. And any authenticated user who's authenticated against a domain can read that profile. But when you apply this patch, they found out security risk in this, and to mitigate it with a man in the middle attack, I'll put a link in the show notes again to this Microsoft TechNet article, this blog, which basically explains why they have done it. And what you should do is you should never remove the authenticated users, because what happens is that the authenticated user needs to read the group policy so it can apply it. So what you should keep it so that you should basically apply it. Sorry. Authenticated users should say basically that you could be able to read the group policy, but you obviously don't want everyone authenticated users to apply. So if you select deny, then that's the way to go. And then you add in your security group, which you want to apply it to, and then you say there you want it to read it and you want to apply it, and that basically means how you can officially apply a group policy to a group, if that makes sense. But a lot of people found out when this patch was applied is that loads of group policies were not being applied because the way that Microsoft updated the way it of enforcing this thing, because in the past it didn't matter that authenticated users wasn't there, you just got an error if you do the GPU results. It's basically once you look on the computer, you can run GPU result and it'll basically tell you what group policies apply to that computer or user. Okay, so we've had a problem like where they couldn't read the group policy, or the group policy was denied. So like, you can tell the group policy today, my documents are redirected to the server. And there's an option there which says that if this policy ever gets removed, copy the files back to the local PC. So because obviously what happened is that they hadn't put authenticated user in, had been removed. When it came to apply this policy, obviously it goes, oh, hang on a minute, there's no authenticated user, I'm not going to apply that policy. And it says copy, and it says if ever this group policy is removed, copy this files back to the local machine. So like, we had loads of logons because everybody was trying to log on to the domain. Everyone was copying their server documents from the server to the local machines. So a bit of a nightmare one there. So I'll put a link in the show notes for that. So if you come across it, why are you finding that your group policy is not being applied?
So this update came through, and then did basically no one have a clue that this was going to happen in the first place? Have Microsoft just changed the rules?
No, because they just enforced it, basically. I found out about it by one of the blogs I followed. They showed you that that you should, that applying this, that this patch was coming out would break your group policy. Check how your group policy has been set up, because the always recommendation from Microsoft is that you should have authenticated users should always have read of the group policy. But easily what you can do is, if you don't know what you're doing or you haven't been taught correctly, if you remove authenticated users from group policy, it doesn't apply it, kind of thing. So
that's it, yeah.
So we're one to keep in the back pocket if you get any problems in the next couple of weeks.
So out of all the things, how many of your clients or how many users did you have that had this slow log? So were you aware of this beforehand, or did you get a load of complaints about slow logins on and then find out afterwards?
Well, no, I found out about it on the day, the patch day, whatever, patch Tuesday came out, and I basically threw it around to our team saying, look, this is coming out, you want to know this, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So
you had people phoning up complaining soon after.
Well, no, we had people phoning up complaining, like, why my map drive's not getting mapped and why is it slow log on or whatever. So, yeah. And then I said, well, hang on a minute. And obviously then start looking at why group policies aren't being applied. And it was because, like, someone had done a shortcut and that basically removed the link, the authenticated users.
So it was only to specific sort of, so it depended on how your group policy was set up.
Yeah.
Originally, whether it affected you or not, or affected them.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's my first thing of the week. How's everyone else?
Well, I've had an interesting week. I've been learning all sorts of new stuff. Now, this is not work related. This has just started off as a little. It was just me messing about to begin with, and then I've ended up learning more and more and more. So I don't know what came over me, but one day, a couple of weeks ago, I suppose it was, I just suddenly thought I should download Ubuntu Server as an ISO, and then just install it on a VirtualBox and see what happens, see what it does. So we did, and installed it. And then almost to the shock and horror, found out that the entire thing was a black screen with white writing on it. Mm-hmm. And it was like going back to DOS days. It was both scary but interesting at the same time. And at that point, I had no expectation of what this was like, or what I was going to use it for, or what it can be used for, and all that kind of thing. So after I got it installed, I realized I installed it incorrectly as well, but I'll come back to that in a minute. I just started looking on different tuition things and then different YouTube videos that I found, to find out what to do. And it came quite logically in the end. You know, it wasn't really, you know, illogical to follow. It is quite logical. But I do find that there's a lot more, you know, don't know how to put it really, but visualizing what's going on rather than seeing what's going on. Mm. What I mean by that is, like Windows is like watching the movie, and doing this Linux server is like reading the book. It's also
good way of putting it, I think.
It's also like an adventure game from the 80s, which was text against, Skyrim on the Xbox today. You know, one's very visual and one isn't. So you have to, I don't think use your imagination is the right word, but you have to visualize what you're doing and how you're doing it and what you've done as well.
There are certain tools that kind of make that work within the terminal, kind of thing.
That right?
For instance, like there's this one, the one that I use a lot is called Top. I don't know if you came across that. top. But it's like the task manager for Windows.
Oh, pretty much. Or something.
No, just top. Or I think HTOP is a kind of more modern one. But
okay.
Yeah, but it will tell you the process that's using the most CPU. That's mainly why.
Yes.
It was HTOP I was sharing, Jerry. Basically top with a bit of a more graphical.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you put top in, you basically understand it now. You don't get much of it.
Yeah.
If you do HTOP.
I just use it because the muscle memory mainly, and because I don't know all the keyboard shortcuts for HTOP, but I do for top. So I still use top. Yeah, old school. But I think top has actually improved in recent versions. It's got a lot better kind of thing.
Well, we actually got to that HTOP at the end, and that was really actually interesting to look at. But one of the first things I learned was the clear command, right?
Mm.
I was quite upset actually. And you might know a bit more about this of why CLS doesn't work. I'm very used to typing CLS return and it clears the screen, you know.
I think it's just a DOS thing. It's never been a Linux thing. That's just a DOS thing. But
yeah, that was a basic thing. It was on it used to be on Amstrad Basic and things like that originally.
I remember on the Spectrum. Yeah.
Yeah.
Pro tip: you can do Control L to clear the screen as well.
Oh right. Okay.
So it's even better. Also, Control D if you want to log out. No, it's another one.
Oh, right.
It's
great, you know, because it's all keyboard. It's really useful to know. I mean, I like keyboard commands in Windows because they really, speed things up.
It sounds like you want to get into Vim then.
Wow, I do get into that.
There's a lot of keyboard shortcuts to learn there, and I've been using Linux for years, but I'd never really bothered to learn them all. And it was after I started my new job that this guy was like, he was looking at me funny because he's a Vim user. And he's like, "You don't know any of these keyboard shortcuts, do you?" So I spent quite a few months familiarising myself with how to do things in Vim that I should have learned in the past 8 years or so.
Because VI is the original, isn't it? But if you're on it, and then Vim is just VI improved, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I don't have the original. I mean, the original VI was on the original Unix systems, I think. But
because if you type VI in Ubuntu, it basically comes up with Vim.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it might even be aliased in Vim, but
in Ubuntu, if you just type VI, it's quite a good thing. So.
But I think in Debian, if you type VI, it brings up actual VI, and then the arrow keys don't work because that's not part of VI. That's Vim. And that's one of the things actually. It's HJKL for moving around, and it's actually easier than the arrow keys once you learn. Which, you know, once your fingers realise which one is which.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
And there's a thing, I think it's called Vim Adventures. It's like a little adventure game, little graphical thing, which kind of familiarises you with the keys kind of thing. Yeah, vim-adventures.com. Cool. Yeah, I'll put it in the show notes.
And then there was a thing as well, there's a tutorial as well about Vim on quite a good tutorial on the Linux Voice YouTube or the podcast. They've got a YouTube channel.
Yeah.
Can you show you how you can like do all the colours or whatever?
Yeah, syntax highlighting thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I use it for not programming, but for my Ansible stuff and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, and also I showed. And a nano, forgetting about quit and write and stuff.
I always in my last job, if I ever had to tell a user to edit a text file, I'd get them to use nano because it was easier to tell them. Because otherwise, they'd go, "What you do colon?" And it's well, easy, I'd, you know, it's
I'd
kind
use
of
Vim to begin
more,
with.
WYSIWYG, as they say, what you see is what you get.
What they utterly suggest is, first, I also learned about Sudo Su as well, to be a super user, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you then, can actually use sudo minus I for that. That's a kind of it's a more logical, a more logical thing, because you're with sudo su, you're saying do the su command but as root, kind of thing.
As root. Doesn't it mean super user? Does su mean super user or something?
Yeah.
But one of the things he first suggested that you had that you should do, I suppose, is change the IP from DHCP to a static IP. That was the one first thing that they suggested to do. Okay. So actually said to use Vim. So they explained that Vim was basically like, you know, Notepad, I suppose, in a way, or had some kind of text editor. Mm. I also figured out as well that you've got the ifconfig command is just like ipconfig on Windows.
Kind of, but it does actually, I'm not sure if it does in Windows, but you can actually configure the interface using ifconfig. So you can say ifconfig and then give it an IP address and a netmask and whatever, and that will actually configure the interface.
So what I said, basically, you had to go to, so this is the next thing I learned, that all of the settings are basically in files, aren't they? Because it's all file-driven.
Yeah.
So quite logically, at the command vim, which is a text editor, /etc/network/interfaces, that's the location of the file that holds all of your... DHCP or static or addresses and things like that. So then, just like a text editor, you had to go up and down. You had to. What else did you have to press A or insert to be able to type? Otherwise, you can't type in it.
Yeah.
It said inet. Originally, it said inet DHCP, which I suppose just means grab the next available or the next. You know, ask for it.
Yeah.
It said change it to inet static.
Yeah.
Then underneath, add the line address and give it your own local IP address.
Yeah.
Netmask, gateway, and then DNS name server. Very similar to setting up a static IP on a network card within Windows.
Yeah.
That's very graphical. Whereas this is all in text, but it means exactly the same thing.
Although in Ubuntu, I mean, Ubuntu on desktop, there's a thing called Network Manager, and there's probably different front ends for it, which basically do the same thing, I think. And I think Ubuntu is actually set to use the Network Manager config first, and then it falls back to that interfaces file if it doesn't find the Network Manager config.
But this is where I was happy to start learning all this like in Vim. I don't know if Nano is a bit easier maybe.
But you're probably better off learning Vim.
Yeah.
Now.
Well, I've learned things like once you're in insert mode to type in, then save is escape colon X, is it?
Colon W is actually save. I think colon X will actually exit. So it might save and exit.
Save and exit, because I think it's after a while.
So you have to write, I think, and then.
But you can also do colon Q exclamation mark. And that's exit without save. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then when I did that, when I put those static IPs in, then we went back to ifconfig just to confirm the settings I'd put in was correct. And then reboot, and then you get yourself a static address.
You don't even have to reboot. You can restart networking
I did realise that later, that there's a restart something command or whatever. Mm. But of course, rebooting works, of course, as well.
Yeah.
Right, then I'm just going off some notes that I made at the time, you see. because I was doing this in VirtualBox, it kind of complicated the issue a bit, because VirtualBox is kind of, you know, in between. Well, I had to put it here, right? Because of VirtualBox, I had to change the network interface in the image settings to bridge mode. This is within VirtualBox. At this point, I should be able to use PuTTY in Windows to remotely access the Ubuntu server using SSH. However, at this point, I could not get PuTTY to work. I kept getting a communications error in a PuTTY dialog box. Mm. I could ping the server from Windows. I could ping the router from Ubuntu, and I could ping 8.8.8 from Ubuntu. After much trolling around the forums, I realized I had to install SSH on the Ubuntu server. Yeah,
that's what I was about to say.
Yeah, because when I did the original install, it asks you what functionalities you want to install while you're installing the whole server, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. And I think at the time I left them all blank. For better or for worse, I mean, I obviously learned how to do it then.
Mm.
So then I had to use the command sudo apt-get install openssh/server. And then it did a load of stuff on screen, you know. It's doing a load of blah, blah, blah on the screen. And as soon as it did that, I could then use PuTTY to connect to the Ubuntu server.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was desktop share, it was showing me all sorts of stuff with PuTTY. You know, that's much better than using it directly. It's basically because you can put this you could put one of these servers, you know, anywhere in your house or wherever it happens to be. And of course, it doesn't need a monitor or a keyboard or mouse, does it?
Yeah,
headless.
You know, once you've got it set up, you know, you could stick it in the garage or somewhere. As long as all you need is power and a network cable.
Yep.
And as long as it's pre-set up, at least up to this SSH stage, then you can use PuTTY from there on, can't you?
Mm-hmm.
But Al was showing me all these things about, especially copying information into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right clicking is like a paste and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah,
so much easier. Yeah. And doesn't it do colors a lot better as well? I can't remember. Does PuTTY do colors?
It does. But yeah, because obviously you were going through the console of the box.
Yeah.
So it's good.
Yeah. Well, it was really good. And then I did several other things because I was actually trying to get to grips with what am I going to use this. I mean, I know this is only on VirtualBox, but ultimately I want to, you know, at this point I was thinking I could use this for something a bit more than, you know, a bit more permanent than that. And then the next thing that it suggested setting up was an FTP server as well. So we ended up using FileZilla to log onto it and look at it on an FTP server. And again, I couldn't connect to it on FTP either. And that was the reason for that is I had to install VSFTPD on the server as well, which I hadn't done previously. And there's a question. Why is it called VSFTPD? What's the VS and the D stand for?
Apparently it stands for Very Secure FTP Daemon.
Oh, right. Okay.
I think it says it in the config file, so you obviously didn't look in the config file.
Well, I had to change something in the config file, which said, so again, using Vim, I had to go Vim etc vsftpd.conf, right, which is that. And then there's a hashtag, like a comment thing in the line which said uncomment this to allow any form of FTP write command, because I could connect to the FTP initially, but if I tried to make a new folder within FileZilla, it wouldn't allow me to do it, or it wouldn't allow me to drag anything onto it. So I had to go into that comp file, remove that hashtag to take the comment out, and then it worked after that. So that was pretty good. And then the next thing was with the bit which I was really kind of most interested in using it for, is to install, make it into a Samba server, basically. So so I used the command apt-get install Samba. And this is the bit where I suddenly realized, now all the, because I've heard you talk about it before, and to be honest, previous to all this, when you've been talking about it, it's just sounded like blah 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 to me. but now after doing this, it's kind of like all making sense. You know, because you two would be saying SSH blah 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 putty blah blah blah, and it's just kind of like glazed over. But now I know exactly what it all means. Well, not exactly what it means, but now I know what you're talking about. But then I realized that all these NAS drives and things like that, they're just one of these, I suppose, aren't they?
Yeah, and mostly they're just Linux boxes underneath and, you know, running their kind of own Linux.
They might come in a very small box. But I was actually thinking, I was going to ask them actually one of the dentist surgeries that I go to if I can have one of their old computers, because I thought all I need is an old tower, maybe a mini one or something, you know, an old tower, a decent sized hard drive I could put in it for storage, and maybe a gigabit network card.
Not even that. You could probably use a Raspberry Pi and a USB drive. Because Raspberry Pi, I've got one here, which I keep meaning to set up to do various little bits, like internal DNS, on my home network. What else? I was hoping to use it because I just recently got solar panels. I was hoping to be able to like grab some information off there over the network. It's kind of it's very low power, but it'll just sit there all day and do that kind of thing,
Yeah,
and it's a little Linux box, you know.
Oh yeah, I was thinking that a little. I mean, this is more of a project for me to kind of play about with, really. But I thought an old tower, a hard drive for storing stuff on, a Samba set up on it, you know, and then it's just like a network drive, isn't it?
Yeah, but stick some more hard drives in it if it's a tower, and you can play around with RAID and things like that as well.
Well, what me and Al were looking at when he did the remote desktop share was backup, and we were going through a couple of commands, weren't we, for rsync and what's the other one called? Using rsync and crontab to schedule different backups.
Yeah.
And also, he was explaining as well how you can add a second hard drive, either USB or internal SATA. And he was explaining how you had to mount the drive, because it doesn't work the same as Windows, where it just allocates a file letter. You have to mount it into the media directory. And
well, you can mount it anywhere, but media is like it's kind of standard
place. Yeah. And then I can't remember. I'll have to remind me of this. But we set up a little backup, didn't we? Which was synchronize every two. How did we do that? Every 2 minutes.
Yeah. So we're using fstab to basically auto mount the drive every time it rebooted. And then we're using crontab to run rsync to sync the Samba, whatever we had shared in the Samba folder, onto the thing.
Yeah.
But we had a bit of a problem because we because Quantab is obviously don't use it very often. It we wanted to run it every 2 minutes, but we put the wrong. Doesn't it show? It shows you, doesn't it? So like
there is a site I've been to which will tell you. You kind of do it in plain English.
And
then it gives you.
I think I googled it and found the same thing.
Yeah.
And the way I thought I was running it every 2 minutes wasn't actually running it every 2 minutes. I was running it every 2 minutes, like on every hour or something.
It was 2 minutes past every hour, wasn't it, or something?
Yeah, not every 2 minutes you wanted to run.
I think it's *2 is every 2 minutes.
Yeah. We're always doing *2, **, whatever. I thought it was like, cause on the Chrome tab, it like says, like minute or seconds, minutes, date or whatever, doesn't
it? Yeah, minute, hour, date, month, and weekday. And I still have to look it up every time.
I looked at one command, and if one of you know this, then this would be good, because there's a couple of switches after the rsync, and I think it's to do with synchronizing or backing up and a difference, right? So basically what I want to know next is after the rsync command, there's a dash A, V.
Yeah.
These are the ones they suggested, A, V, and Z. And then progress was another one.
Is that capital? That's capital P, isn't it?
Is it? Oh, right, yeah. So
yeah, it's a lot of them either two different, you know, can you have either capital P or dash dash progress, I think. Yeah.
Well, I took one as being A as being attributes, is it?
Yeah.
Copy
A,
the attributes.
A is actually a load of different ones, which you can use A or you can use all the different ones. And it's like it's ownership permissions, whether it's a link or not. You know, all that kind of thing. Exactly.
Date created and date modified. Yeah.
That's it. Yeah.
Okay. Now the second one.
Verbose.
Right. What does verbose mean?
Verbose. You find that in quite a lot of commands. If you do -V, it puts more output than it would otherwise, because Linux commands are mostly designed to have no output, and no output is actually a good thing. If there's no output after a command, then you can generally assume it's worked with Linux or Unix. It's just a kind of efficiency thing, which is a kind of general Unix thing. So verbose, it will put more output than is this kind of general output of the command. A lot of the time you can do multiple Vs as well. So if you try -V, try -VV or VVV.
All right.
see how that goes, because then you get more information out. But generally, once you know it's working, you take the Vs out and you get no output, unless it's an error. So.
Okay.
Yeah. I think Z is to do with compression over. So when it does the sync, it will compress the data, so it takes less time, and decompress it at the other end.
So, what we're going to ask you, so if you rsync two folders, depending on what options you do, so what happens if you delete something on the other side on one? So, if you've got folder A and you're rsyncing to folder B, if you delete a folder in folder A, or delete a folder in folder A, does that folder get that file get deleted on folder B?
No, not automatically.
Does it depend on...
There's a dash dash delete option. There's no synonym, as they call it. No alternative for that. You have to do dash dash delete.
So if you put that in,
it will give you a mirror of what you've got on the source end. Okay. So. And another good tip with rsync is there's a -N option, which is dry run. So it will say what it's going to do, won't actually do it.
That's great. All right. So what would you want to use for it? Would you recommend using that as a backup in situation?
If you want a proper backup, I would say use rsnapshot, which is a wrapper to rsync. And what it does is it will doing an rsync, and then the next time it comes to do an rsync, it basically makes a copy of what you've done using a feature in Linux to do with the file system called hard links. So it basically it takes that original backup, and then it knows what it's already got, so it only backs up the differences. So it's basically an incremental backup.
Incremental, yeah.
And then you set it up so you've got an hourly one, and normally I do that every 4 hours. So you put that in the cron tab to do every 4 hours, the hourly one. And then you have a daily one, which you do every day, obviously. And then it takes the last daily one, makes a copy of that, and then does a new daily one. And then you can do weekly and monthly after that. So it gives you incremental backups, but it doesn't take up the whole space that it would need for however many backups you're choosing to do. So.
Yeah, because I was going to ask, would rsync, do you get like the bit where you could go back like three versions?
No, no.
I'm guessing with that.
No, not by default.
Would rsync, right.
Yeah, and depending what file system you use as well, it's like ButterFS and ZFS, you can alter this r snapshot command so that it uses the copy on write things of the file system, so you do get proper snapshots then. Whereas on a normal Linux file system, you just get these hard links, which are they do the same thing, but it's not within the file system; it's kind of a layer on top of the file system. So.
Okay. So how do you restore then, if you wanted to restore? Is there like a command you can name?
Well, you just go into your... It makes a load of directories, and you go into... You look for the date that you want. You go into there, and you can just go down into the file system. And and if it's an older one, then the file will just be there because it's linked. It's hard linked.
Okay. So, cool.
Yeah, works pretty well.
So yeah, because like, you get the same sort of thing with... So the FS, don't you, where you get the snapshots and stuff?
Yeah.
So you can basically say restore this partition to how it was.
But that's at the file system level, whereas our snapshot kind of works a layer above that. So it's not the file system itself doing it. It's kind of something within the OS doing it, I suppose.
So I suppose you've got the chance here, I suppose, with this cron tab. So this cron tab is like a scheduler, isn't it, I suppose? Is it like a task scheduler in Windows?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you tell it a time that you want it to do something, or a range of times that you want it to do something.
Yeah.
And it does it. It just runs a thing at that time.
So you don't need... So you can actually do multiple commands in cron tab then.
Yeah, yeah, it's just a list.
Dates and different times.
Each line is just a list. It's a list of things to do.
It just monitors the time. So when this time equals this time, then it just does it.
Yeah.
So what I thought then is, say you had a daily, a weekly, monthly incremental sort of backup. You could, I suppose, say have three mounted hard drives into the computer, and then have... dailies go onto one hard drive, monthlies go onto the other hard drive, weeklies go onto the other hard drive, and have three different hard drives with three different backups on.
Yeah, you could do that.
For example, either internal or...
Yeah. You probably have to run three different instances of our snapshot. If you're doing it that way. But the power of our snapshot is that hard linking thing. So any data that's already got, it doesn't back up again, kind of thing. And when you do the initial backup, it's got all the data, and it's so it only backs up any changes to the data.
We also had a bit of fun with the... we were mounting a second hard drive, didn't we, Al? Because we were trying to partition and format it. Mm-hmm. And we're having a bit of fun with doing that as well, weren't we?
Just make sure you don't format the wrong hard drive.
Well, yeah.
Same as Windows, really. But
yeah. What were the? I'm just looking at the commands I've got here. LSHW class disk. Was that to list the devices? Was it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then from that list, you had to figure out which one was yours. That you were talking about, And then we had the sudo fdisk-l. Is that the list? I can't remember now. Because at that point, we then found out it was it was SDB, wasn't it? Not an SDA, it was SDB.
Yeah. SDA is usually the hard drive that you're running the system
on. Yeah, so this was a secondary one we added within VirtualBox. So then we had sudo fdisk-dev, which is short for device, I've found out, / SDB. So I suppose that means fdisk, that particular hard drive. And then, is this the bit we went wrong? Sudo makefilesystem, mkfs, / t, ext4. I've since learned that's just like FAT32 or NTFS. It's just a full file system.
Yeah, it's like the standard Linux file system, yeah.
Yeah. / dev / sdb1 as partition 1.
Yeah. So so SD is the hard drive, basically. B is the kind of the number. So B is usually like the second hard drive, and then the 1 is the partition number on that hard drive. So
you could potentially have, like Windows, I suppose, you can have 2, 3, 4 partitions if you wanted for certain things.
Yeah. It still uses the kind of, you're familiar with primary and extended partitions and that.
Yeah.
You still have to deal with all that, yeah. But
it's just 1, 2, yeah.
Yeah.
What we did after that is we had to make a directory to mount the drive into.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to sudo make directory, mkdir, / media, and we just called it backup drive.
Mm-hmm.
And then the mount was sudo mount - dev - sdb1.
Yeah.
And then the location of the directory.
Yeah. Yeah, the mount command is just the mount this thing to this location. So
yeah.
The thing is dev sdb1 and the location is media or whatever. I mean, I was doing this. I had to do a similar thing last week with an NFS mounted partition. So think of it as like a Windows share. And so I had to go mount and then name of this remote system : directory on the remote system, and then afterwards the location of where I wanted to mount it to. So it's exactly the same in that way. Yeah.
So I could visualize all that. That was pretty good. And that's when Al then introduced me to the Nano text editor.
Yeah.
Because we had, so then what we wanted to do then was so we then wanted to edit the file system tab to mount the drive on every boot. That's what we did next.
Yeah.
So, I'm just looking at my notes. I can't find it now.
And I was telling Andy about what I do is in my Dropbox, I have loads of text files with everything in I ever do. So if I know a command, like this is what I did, I've got a command, which is basically, like for mounting this hard drive, and then I basically have a text file, and it basically in there it shows me what I can do. I do it with everything, like PowerShell command, anything like that, just so that I've got somewhere to go. Where I know I've done that in the past. I know it works. I'm going to go back to it.
Kind of. Yeah.
I even got to things now where I've done where I've printed. I love in Chrome where you can print to PDF. So I've had in the past where you've gone back to a gone to a blog and it's gone disappeared. So I like if I've got a good blog, I put it, print it to PDF, and put it into my Dropbox. So like my little thing kind of thing.
I should do more of that, but I don't know. I think I always trust that that stuff's going to be there when that's probably not a safe assumption to make. But
It's like a manual of manual way of doing Evernote, isn't it, I suppose?
Yeah, yeah.
What you're doing.
Something I've started doing is if a script I've written a script, which is a script is just basically a list of commands, that you can just type on the command line. And I've, the ones that I'm particularly happy with, I put them on GitHub, so that they'll always be there, and other people can use them if they find them useful, kind of thing. I could put a link in the show notes if anyone's interested, but. Yeah, there's a few bits and bobs there.
So we did all this. We had an interesting time getting all this lot set up, but it was good to mess about with. And you know, since me and Al done that to sort of see how it all worked, I've actually wiped it and started again.
Yeah.
because doing it again, repetition, just makes you learn more, doesn't it? I suppose, and take it in a bit better. But one question we did have was, in the likes of Windows and the likes of programs like Acronis, which does a complete image of the entire hard drive, the whole thing, right? Does Linux, Ubuntu server, whatever, have a similar kind of thing? You know, so while we're saying this, if the hard drive completely crashed out or whatever, you had your backups all done. If the hard drive completely crashed, would you then have to rebuild it exactly the same as you did before? Or is there a way that you can image the drive and then copy the image onto a new one?
There's a couple of interesting options here. There always are with Linux. the DD command will do a bit-for-bit copy of one thing to another. So you can say DD and then the input file is dev.sta. So you can literally, because that's part of the thing about Unix and Linux is everything's a file. So that /dev/sdb1, it can actually be treated as a file. So you can say take sdb1, sda1 or whatever, your partition, and write it to a file. And you do that using the dd command. And there is... if you listen to a couple of Ubuntu podcasts ago, the DD command, there's not much output. You can't really tell what it's doing, but there's a way of telling it to tell you the progress of it. So normally you do the DD command, and you might come back a couple of hours later and it's done. But there is actually a way of telling you how far along it's got now. I mean, there's a completely separate way of doing that using a different program, and that's another thing about Unix. I don't know if you've learned about piping things to other things. The pipe command, which is next to the left shift key on the keyboard, basically it says take this command and take the output of that command and pipe it into a completely different command and use that command to do something else. And that's kind of quite a central thing in Unix. You have each thing does its thing. And then you can take the output of that and pass it to something else. And then that will do that thing. And then you can pass it as many things as you want. I mean, like something to do, like, for instance, if you... have you come across the cat command to show you the contents of a file?
No.
So if you do cat and then a file, it'll just print the file out to the screen. So what if it's more than one screen long? What you can do then is you can use the pipe command, and then there's another command called less, and that lets you use the cursor keys to go up and down a file. So you do the cat command and then pipe it into less, and then you can go up and down the thing. You can actually use the less command on its own to do that as well, but it's just an example. The command line is all about that, kind of piping things into other things.
And you can type touch, can't you, as well? You can type, if you type touch and the name, it will, a file name, and it will then create that file, won't it?
Yeah. Or it'll update the timestamp on the file if the file already exists.
And the other thing I was showing was the CP command to copy a file before you ever edit a file.
Yeah.
I always like to make a backup of a file. But probably you don't. do that, but I always like to do that just in case. Just
I still do that. Even though a lot of things I do are under version control, it's useful to still do that. But yeah, that's another thing. Just to make your file or set of files that you're editing into a Git repository and then commit before you do anything. Yeah, that's handy as well.
Is that for the didn't we copy the so no one edited the interfaces file, right? Is that copy that interfaces file somewhere else?
Onto
the Windows desktop, for example, and then all I'd have to do in the future is just if I ever made a new server again, I could just copy it back, and it's all done. Yeah, you don't have to configure it or copy and paste or save it. Yeah. Just copy it.
Although if you get too much into that,
once you've made a file, configured a file, you can just keep it and copy it.
Though if you're doing a lot of automated stuff like that, I'd suggest using Ansible. It's really easy to get into. If it's easy enough for me, then I'm sure it's pretty easy. So
that's basically all I've done with that since the last episode and that. But it's been really interesting and just figuring out the way I see it is like figuring out how all this stuff works behind the scenes.
Mm.
I suppose. I mean, Windows does exactly the same thing, just in a different way, I suppose. But you're just seeing it from behind the scenes of how it all works. And the only problems I was having is when I was messing about and I'd done something wrong, the problem I had was fixing things once I'd done it wrong, because I didn't know what I'd done wrong.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing with working in a VM, but you can always take a snapshot before you do something, can't you? And
I haven't. I just messed something up. I can't remember what I messed up. But I messed something up and then I couldn't figure out what I'd done wrong. I think I did in the end. You know. But yeah, it was really, really good. I've also got I got it to see it within Windows as well. So you could go to networks in Windows and then you could give it a drive letter if you want and all of that. Yeah. So that was really good as well. And that's what we're testing. We're copying stuff over. And that's where I was looking at the... that's what Al was talking about before with the does it delete it after you've backed it up?
Mm.
You know, if you delete a file from folder A, does it delete it from folder B?
Yeah.
And we tried that and it didn't. Which actually leads on to something else, which is a job that I've done this week. Nothing went wrong with this job, but a very similar thing with and it was really strange because I was listening to one of the Podnuts episodes and somebody had exactly the same thing happen to him on the Podnuts episode that happened to me as well. because it was basically to do with somebody was using Dropbox as a backup. And I said, and I don't know if you have different views on this, I said Dropbox isn't a backup. It's a synchronization tool. Because if you delete something from Dropbox, it deletes it from everywhere, doesn't it?
Hmm.
Because it synchronizes it.
You need to have something that backs up your Dropbox, really, on a regular basis.
But he was using Dropbox as a backup. Yeah. And when I explained, I said, you had a file on your desktop, but Dropbox folder on your desktop, which is how he's using it. And say you never accessed it very much, but you needed to keep it. And say you unknowingly deleted it from your desktop, it would then synchronize and delete it from the Dropbox server as well.
I think you can get file versioning with Dropbox, but I think once the file's gone, it's gone.
Well, I've found out since, so I might be wrong, but there's a 30-day thing with Dropbox where if you delete it, you can get it back within 30 days.
Mm.
Now, I don't know if you have to pay. I don't know if you have a paid subscription in order to access that. I'm not entirely sure, but I said, some files you never access that often, but you need them there just in case. If you accidentally delete it, and you don't check it within 30 days, it's gone, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And when I explained to him about that, he was like, oh yeah, never thought of it like that. You know, but there was somebody on one of the Podnuts episodes, can't remember which one it was now, who had exactly the same thing, using Dropbox as a backup. And that's because, and that's where I was thinking, our sync is it a synchronization program or is it a backup program? You know, it's and not, what the differences were.
It's not a backup program, but it can be used for, it can be used with other things, like a lot of things with Linux, to make it into a backup program, yeah. I suppose.
So is that other one you mentioned more of a backup program?
Our snapshot, yeah. I mean, our snapshot yeah. is it's just a wrapper around rsync. It's a kind of a massive script. It's actually a Perl, written in Perl, I think, which provides that functionality of an actual backup. Yeah.
Well, that's great. Well, that's all I've got to talk about. Only about 3 hours of conversation there, but. But yeah, it was really good. And I'll update with any progress that I do or any other stuff that I do on it in future episodes. Or if I get stuck, I might be contacting one of you again.
Yeah, no problem.
How the hell do you do this or something?
Cool. So what have you been up to then, Jerry?
Well, there's not a lot of time to talk about what I've been up to, but that's okay. Could leave it till next time. Should we do that? We're in the hour or so. Don't want to bore the listeners. But no, I just had a... I've been to Glastonbury, well, it was a couple of weeks ago now, and I just had so much work leading up to it. It was ridiculous. I had a load of freelance stuff to get done. I had three... LAMP servers, which is Linux, Apache, MySQL, PHP, to set up. Two of them with one client and one with another to set up in less than a week or so before I went. And at work, the SSL certificate that that secures the development... all the development stuff ran out the weekend before I went. So I thought I'd prepared for this. So, you know, I thought I sorted it out the week before I went, so everything would be okay. But it turns out that it wasn't, because there was a couple of issues. So the main place that the SSL certificate needed replacing was on the load balancers, though. The way that we work in my day job with AWS is anything that's facing the internet is behind a load balancer, even if it's just a single machine. So load balancers in general, what they do is they take traffic from the internet and they pass that traffic on to servers behind them in network terms. And say there's three servers behind one load balancer, it would send one request to one server, one request to another server, one request to another server. I think that's called round robin. And they also do SSL termination. So if you get an SSL request, it comes to the load balancer. Basically, all the SSL stuff is stripped off, and then it goes to the server as a normal HTTP request with no security.
SSL offloading, so that obviously doing all the mathematical decrypting and decrypting of the traffic is on a load balancer, it's got a lot more performance than having on your web server.
So I replaced the SSL certificate on those, and it all worked fine. But I didn't do it on our Jenkins server, which is the thing that builds the code and then gets ready to deploy. So that was an issue. And then as I was walking out of work, I got a message saying, this still needs sorting out. So I thought it'd be a good idea to try and fix it on the train home. So I set off doing that. And I think I must have made a mistake with the Terraform code. And that basically took the load balancer for Jenkins, the build server and so on, down. And it wasn't contactable for the entire time I was away. I was at Glastonbury for just under a week, so I didn't have my laptop with me and didn't really have any way to fix it. So, yeah, that was interesting. So what it ended up being was that load balancer was half configured and it wasn't actually serving any traffic. So once I'd worked that out, when I got back, I'd fix that, and that was all okay. Another issue was we're using Amazon CloudFront. Now that's a content delivery network, which you can think of as a load of load balancers around the world serving data. And with Amazon, everything is a service, so you have a CloudFront, and what we're using CloudFront in this instance for is to do the SSL termination, which we just discussed, and the data is held in another service called S3, which is basically the Amazon storage service. So CloudFront is just doing that SSL termination onto this S3 service, and the certificate that I had made for the dev machines wasn't supported by CloudFront, and that was the main problem. So I had to, when I got back, I got a different certificate, because you can have multiple certificates securing the same domain, and in this case it was you can actually go to it. It's a public URL, apt.dev.compose.com. The certificate that's securing that is a completely separate certificate to the one that's securing star.dev.compose.com, and that's how I solved it. So CloudFront has a different certificate. If you go there, you can go to it, https://apt.dev.compose.com. That's my day job's public APT, which is the Debian packaging tool repository. And it works now. You won't get any errors if you go there, whereas before you would have done. You would have got an SSL error, and that SSL error actually caused the machines that the dev machines to not be able to deploy code. So for the entire time I was away, no one could deploy any code, and as it's a company that practices continuous deployment, that was a bit of a downer, really. So the moral of this story is lots of preparation needed before going away, I think.
At least the certificate didn't expire one year away.
Yeah, well, I thought I'd got it all covered, but I hadn't. And I hadn't really had to work with SSL certificates before, so a bit of a baptism of fire, I suppose.
With your private and public keys or whatever.
So you have to generate a private key. You generate a certificate. What is it? You generate a private key. That's the main thing that you need to keep secret. And from that, you generate a certificate signing request. You send a certificate signing request to the certificate authority.
CSR.
Yeah. The certificate authority generate a certificate and ask you to prove that you own the domain that you're trying to secure. And then once you've done that, you get a certificate back. And then the certificate is put on the thing that you're securing. And hey presto, you've got a HTTPS set up. PKI, public key infrastructure. It's cool, isn't it? Yeah.
I had to this week convert a Windows certificate for one of our customers, had a wildcard certificate for their Windows servers, and they had a Linux server hosted their website, and I had to convert the using OpenSSL to convert it from a Windows certificate into a Linux certificate so that it could be used in Apache.
Oh, okay. Are they different then? Are they
certificates? Yeah, because it's just formatted in a different way, that's all.
Oh, okay.
So I'll put a link in the show notes so the article I found, but basically you export it from Windows and then you run a command in OpenSSL and it converts it into like the .key file or whatever which you have in Linux.
Okay.
And then the public and private key.
Yeah. There's quite a good page I found of all the different OpenSSL commands, because on Linux anyway, that's what you use to generate these private key in the CSR and so on. Which you're sending to the certificate authority. It's a bit different. Let's Encrypt, which is the kind of free SSL certificates for anyone, is a little bit different the way it works. Maybe we could cover that in a future episode.
Have you actually deployed a certificate yet with that?
Well, Let's Encrypt, my own server is using Let's Encrypt. Certificates only last for 90 days, I think, whereas most the ones that you buy are normally a year, or you can pay for longer, but a minimum of a year. So you have to set up a cron job to kind of renew them automatically. I'm actually using SSL termination for my server as well, so I've got an Nginx server doing that, and then kind of all the services kind of set up behind it in NAT configuration, so like it would be on a home network, which you could actually use to secure your home network, I suppose, doing it that way. Expose port 443 on your router and nothing else, maybe.
Cool, okay.
Yeah. I'll leave it at that for this episode, anyway.
Anyway, how did you deploy the free LAMP server? Did you just set it up from scratch, each of them, or anything?
Ansible. In a word, Ansible. Cool. Problem is, I'd never done it. I'd never set up a whole LAMP server from scratch in Ansible, so it probably took me as long to write the Ansible code to do that. But at least if I have to do it again, it won't take as long. That's what I hope, anyway. Unless I decide to refactor some code or something like that. I might actually put that up on my GitHub other people can benefit from it.
Cool. I'll put in the show notes, well, I actually had to deploy WordPress on the Linux, on a Windows server this week as well.
How strange.
So, yeah. We got given some of the company come along and said, can you install WordPress on this server on a Windows server so that we can deploy WordPress on the Windows server? I'll put this in the show notes. It's quite good. It's basically used RIS and it puts PHP, MySQL and stuff on the server.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's quite interesting.
Did you use, WAMP? WAMP?
I don't know. I found there's a utility in Windows. I just Googled install WordPress.
Okay.
And it basically part of the install. WAMP, you said. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a thing called, it's like a utility you can download from Windows, and you basically install it. And it basically installs all the things you need for it to work, and then you can get it working. So, that's quite cool. I did see we had a ping back on our site from the Foolish Tech Show, mentioning us. So thanks for the mention. But they were talking about the EU referendum. We won't mention it here because I expect us three could discuss it for the next 3 hours.
Yeah.
And we can all... we were banned from talking about it at work on the day after. I don't know if they knew it was a comedy, but they actually put a link in their show notes about why Britain joined the EU from YouTube. I don't know if they knew it was actually Yes Minister. So wasn't that a comedy from the 1970s?
Yeah.
I don't know if they actually think that's how we act over here. Kind of thing. Or if it was actually.
But that was when we joined.
There was Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister.
Yeah.
Eventually it went to, yeah.
That's probably from when we joined in 1973, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's what they're saying. That's what it has come from. Yeah. So yeah, I'll put a link in the show notes to that so you can have a look at that. So thanks for the kind words and stuff. Mm. So, yeah, I've still got loads to talk about. So maybe
we might have to put out more than one episode every couple of months to cover all this. We've already got more content than we can handle.
Yeah. Good. All right, okay. Well, thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you all soon then.
Don't forget, mail at admin@adminpodcast.co.uk.
We haven't had any emails lately.
So keep it up, guys. And and our social media outlets, which we really should cultivate more, I think. Yeah.
All right. I'll speak to everyone soon. Bye for now.
Cheers, guys. Bye.